Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Family Matters. I'm Jill Agisi, and I'm here with my co-host, Judge Michelle Lawrence. Welcome, Michelle.
Hi, Jill. How are you?
Well, I'm fine, but I feel like we have not been on the air together for so very long because you were gone. You were with Faye Levin, the ambassador to the Netherlands. I was getting an award, and then you were off somewhere doing something else, and you're, you know, taking care of all your great responsibilities. So we haven't been together for a while. We had that great book signing Tuesday night in Chicago, which was so much fun.
Yeah, the 8 authors. That was good.
That was really fun, and we'll give a little plug for our friend Karen Calabrese with her restaurant, Karen's Green, Karen's Cooked, Karen's Raw. We had such a good time there, and about 350 people were in and out looking at books all night. I didn't sell that many books. I think I gave some away, but it was an interesting crowd and had a lot of fun.
You know, the book signing is getting to be a thing of the past.
You know, I agree with you, Michelle. When the publicists are setting me up for these book signings, I feel like people come and stare at you like you're in a fishbowl, and they don't know whether to, you know, they don't know whether to turn loose if they're $22.95 or not. And I would rather, much rather, be on Amazon and Barnes and Noble, and or have people contact me through their website. Don't you think?
Yeah, well, I just think that, you know, when any time that we're a part of something like that, we're a part of history, because Borders is closing down. It's just. It breaks my heart because I don't know what I'm going to buy till I get there. So
yeah, you're right.
For me to go on Amazon is not the whole experience.
Well,
anyway.
If people are going on Amazon tonight, though, I have to tell them you need to take a look at The Good Karma Divorce, which is Michelle's book that came out this year, and what a great tool for divorcing couples and really for anyone in conflict. Gives you a manifesto that you can sort of plan what is going to happen in your future and lets you know what this whole system is like that we talk about every Wednesday night. And so The Good Karma Divorce, and what's your website, Michelle?
TheGoodKarmaDivorce.com.
That's a really good name for that.
Yeah,
I
right.
Love it.
Right, exactly.
I love it. Well, so. we generally try to talk about a subject that's near and dear to my heart because I'm an alienated mom and I'm president of Parental Alienation Awareness Organization, and I roped you into being my co-host because you are doing such revolutionary things in your courtroom in Cook County in Chicago, and I'm so proud to have opened your eyes about this whole subject, and you are doing just these great things in your courtroom, and I know you see these cases so often.
Well, and the reason that I like to be on the show, Jill, is because I think that what I'm trying to do is prevent it from getting to this point and try to find ways to interrupt the cycle and the negative reactive cycle that people automatically get into because of the divorce process. People are so terrified, and they become defensive, and then their fear gets amped up, and they start responding to each other, and the parent alienation being the far end of the spectrum. But
because divorce is really bifurcated, isn't it? People don't realize, I think, when they go into the divorce process that it's a legal issue, but it really, most of all, is an emotional issue. And so what would you tell people who are entering into a divorce and how to handle the emotional end of it?
Well, you have to learn how to manage your emotions so that you are not triggered by reactivity and your own anger and your own resentment, which is so understandable. And in the beginning of the process, most people have it because it feels like power, and it masquerades as power better than anything else I know. It gives you a surge of adrenaline, and it motivates you to do things, and it's a invisible electric fence that tells you can't do that to me, but as a sustained modality to get from through a divorce. It's depleting, it takes away your energy, and it leaks down into your children, and which is where our guest comes in.
Absolutely. And as she sits so patiently and quietly, right. I want to introduce our lovely guest who was so kind to be with us here tonight. And she's freezing where she is, and we're freezing where we are. And I'm telling her that we're having a major snowstorm here in Illinois on Saturday and Sunday, and I bet you she'll get it on Monday or Tuesday. So Joan Meyer, who is a professor of clinical law, she no slouch for sure. She has a Harvard degree. She is nationally recognized. She's an expert on domestic violence and the law and clinical law teaching. She is the founder of the Domestic Violence Legal Empowerment and Appeals Project at George Washington University. And she is just an amazing woman. And she has a little bit different view. She has a real different view on the things that we talk about, but as they relate to domestic violence. So I thought, what an interesting show this would be with Joan, and welcome and thank you for coming on tonight.
Thanks for having me, Jill, and thanks for warning me about that snowstorm. It's changing my plans for the week.
Hope you don't have it. We'll keep our fingers crossed, but I'm excited. My two Bernese mountain dogs are looking forward to it. So
I'm actually a Chicagoan, so I get excited by snow myself.
Yeah.
It's just everyone around me that doesn't like it.
You'll get over it. After this weekend, you'll get over it. Tell us a little bit about your project.
Well,
what is the Domestic Violence Project?
Yeah, well, that's the clinical program that I teach at the law school, where students work in the field, and I teach a seminar and do small group supervision and teach them about domestic violence, teach them about how to practice in the field, do a lot of exchanging of experiences. They get a really broad look at the field, from legislative, federal, local, to litigation, to policy, and they do a lot of work on their own reactions. I really appreciated what you were talking about, Judge Lawrence, about reactivity and triggers, because I teach my students a lot about that, because they find when they're working in this field of domestic violence, all kinds of really intense reactions come up based on their own histories and their own makeup. And so we spend a fair amount of time talking about what is that about and developing self-awareness and how do you manage that. And we also talk about vicarious trauma, which I'm sure you're probably familiar with, but it's what happens.
Familiar with it. I have it on a daily basis. I need medication. Anybody
right. If you work in certainly in family court, I'm sure, but especially in the field of abuse, and I'm sure you get plenty of that, you're being exposed to trauma material, trauma stories all the time, and we take it in and we start to feel traumatized ourselves, and then we have reactions that aren't that constructive. So I talk to my students about that as well. But that's the clinical program.
To follow up on that,
sure.
Would I call you doctor or Joan, or what do you prefer?
Oh, just Joan is fine.
Okay, so you see that in lawyers in the court all the time,
taking on
the coloration of their clients.
Yep.
And it's understandable, but it's really not helpful. Because we need problem solving. When people get into their emotions, it's enough that the litigants do. But when the helpers, the therapist, or when they do as well, it really complicates the issue and takes us farther away from solving problems.
I know, and I hope you can train your colleague judges about it, because I think I see it a lot on the bench, too,
Maybe we need a program about that.
That's a great idea.
Now that seems like we talk about programs that we're going to do all the time to try to educate, and boy, this is one we can sure add to our list.
Yeah. If I may, I just want to go on to talk about sort of the more relevant project that tonight's conversation may relate to more, which is the nonprofit that I run, that I founded. It's called DV Leap, the Domestic Violence Legal Empowerment and Appeals Project, and its specialty is domestic violence litigation at the appellate level. And we do cases all over the country, as well as specializing in D.C. And we also do Supreme Court cases and have had a really great track record so far, except in this area of custody and abuse, which is how I've gotten into the parental alienation issue.
So what's changing about policy in terms of domestic violence that people would be interested to know?
What has changed? Was that the question?
Yeah, if anything. Or what is the goal?
Well, it's an interesting question. I am so immersed in sort of combating what I see as backlash and regression, which is frankly how parental alienation plays in my cases, that it's hard for me to talk about, you know, positive changes. There have been a lot of positive legal changes over the last 30 years or so, but I'd say in the last 10 years or so, it's gotten really, really rough to be an abuse survivor and going to court, much worse than it would have been, I think, 20 years ago.
Why is that?
I see a lot of punishment of abuse victims. I see, and particularly in the family court arena, in the custody court arena, I see women, if they come to court and talk about the father being a danger to the children or to themselves, they get punished. It's a shoot the messenger reaction, and I think it comes from a very good motive, which is a belief that children need two parents and that fathers should be equally in their children's lives. But I think it sort of sets up some judges to feel that women are just coming in and being vengeful and, as you suggested, just operating out of rage rather than often when they're alleging abuse. Most often, it's valid, it's sincere. And I think courts tend to leap to the wrong conclusion about that and to assume...
And you know why? You know what I think has contributed to that? It's that people have gotten pretty sophisticated about the system. And
mm-hmm.
when we were at the first stages of domestic violence court, and so everybody understands, you know, that this is generally physical abuse to the other, to a spouse or to the children, but it can be intimidation and it can be threats. But when it started, most of the people were really, really in danger. Now the people who are in danger have are being penalized in the sense that a lot of people who go to domestic violence want to start a divorce case by getting a spouse thrown out of the house.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you know,
it really gives them an advantage.
I hear so much from judges, and all I can say is I don't know, because from where I sit, I see clients of friends and colleagues being treated as though that's what they're doing when it's not. And so the question is really, do we know or do we assume the worst sometimes for the wrong reasons? One thing that I see happening a lot is that women, they come in, they may be angry, and they may have good reason to be angry, but that anger is interpreted as, therefore, she's lying and she's being vengeful rather than she actually needs to be safe or protect her kids.
Generalizations in a way.
Yeah,
but
it is.
I know that you're not, what you're telling is the truth, and I know that there are people who say, maybe not, maybe they're trying to manipulate the system, but it's hard to know that that's predominant, but that it's not at all is problematic.
I agree. I absolutely agree. And what I do, you know, I take quite seriously, and I credit is the idea that there have probably been lawyers who advise their clients in that direction for the wrong reasons. But again, I've heard judges or people who work with judges complain that this woman was incredible because she went to the shelter because her lawyer told her to. Well, I'm like, maybe your lawyer told her to because she was in danger and she needed to be safe. And if the lawyer told her to go to the doctor to get medical records to use for evidence, that doesn't mean that she's not being battered. That means the lawyer's doing their job and getting the evidence of the battering to bring to court. And often I find the court system seeing that kind of litigation effort, which has to be done. You have to produce evidence if you're going to court, treated as sinister and as sort of a sign that there's no truth there when there's no reason to assume that. Which, you know, at the same time, of course, it's got to be true. And I have heard of some cases, but surprisingly few, where women lied. You know, in like 20-some years of doing this work, I've had like 3 cases come to me where I believe, but I have no way of knowing for sure, but I believe the woman lied. You know, I could be wrong about that, but I'm prepared to believe it. But I've been doing the work for 20 years, and I've had so many women treated as lying when they weren't. So to me, the problem is the other one. But I know that from the bench, it feels like the problem is false allegations.
Maybe, Joan, because you are so specialized in what you do, the women that are funneling to you are the ones that are actually having this problem. But it seems like every day, and I don't know about you, Michelle, who comes in front of your bench, but every day when I'm talking to 25, 35, sometimes 70 alienated people a day, both men and women, because it's not a gender issue, it's coming on both sides, and it's being used against both genders. So, so how do you balance, how do you... rationalize.
Yeah.
Right.
How do you march through it?
Right.
Well, I'll tell you what my proposal is. And I actually just came back from a judicial training in Ohio, and I talked about this there, but I've talked about it a number of places. I've also put it in scholarship. It's in print. My view is this. Alienation is real. I'm sure it happens in both directions, and I'm most sure that that men do it to women because it's what batterers have been doing forever. And back when we would complain about it in the early days of the DV movement, courts would, you know, roll their eyes and they didn't care. They didn't care that the batterer was trashing the mother to the kids. That was not their concern. And one of the reasons I'm suspicious of the theory is not only that it's used against bad women so much, but that it arose and it got taken seriously when it was proposed as a theory to rebut abuse claims. It was never taken seriously at first. I think now it's beginning to be separated out a little. But at first, and it caught on as very powerful as a way to refute abuse, and that's when courts started paying attention to it. And that's how it caught on, and Richard Gardner, PAS, and all of that was all about that. And that's what I see, of course, in my specialized area. Now, that said, I'm also very certain that you guys are right, that there's plenty of alienation going on that may not be about refuting abuse, that may be truly alienation going on.
Mm-hmm.
So my proposal is this. I think the court's job to avoid misusing the theory to wrongfully deny abuse or marginalize the concerns of abuse, what the court should be doing, ideally, and I'd love to see a pilot project, maybe in Chicago, Michelle.
Okay. Let's hear it.
The first stage would be to screen the abuse, to really identify and adjudicate whether there's been abuse, to separate out everything else. Because if there's been domestic violence or child abuse, or if there's grounds, you know, enough threat or reason for concern about dangerousness, the alienation issue, in my view, should be taken off the table, except insofar as it is part of an abusive pattern. So, as I said, abusive batterers will often alienate the kids, and if they get custody, that's usually the end of the maternal relationship. It's over, because batterers are very skilled at intimidating and brainwashing and coercing their kids.
Before you go too much further, I need you to explain to our listeners exactly what the dynamic is with the abuse versus alienation. You assume people know, but,
sure,
but could you break that down at a very elementary level?
You mean in how those two things play out?
How
in
they,
court?
What they have to do with each other, yeah.
Okay, let me give you an example. I have a client in Arkansas who went to court and talked about a long history of domestic violence. There was a lot of breaking up and getting back together. There were three young boys. And some of that domestic violence was credited by the court because, only because, the batterer admitted to kind of minor parts of it. And so two incidents the court credited as incidents of domestic violence. Nonetheless, there was an evaluator who was brought in who's basically Mr. PAS, parental alienation syndrome. And he, you know, that's his thing. It's his cottage industry. And he came in and he talked to her. She talked about the abuse. He talked to the kids.
Who was
the
that?
Kids talked, the name in Arkansas? I'm not sure,
yeah,
I want to... broadcast
okay.
the name.
No, not the client, but who did they bring in?
No, I don't want to broadcast that name either
okay.
because...
Okay,
right,
that's
you know,
right.
But I'm happy to share this with you off the air, and we have briefs with the names in them and
okay.
so forth.
Sure. Okay.
But anyway, he's one of basically two leading evaluators in the state, and not hard to find. But
okay.
but anyway, he came in and he said that she was committing shameless alienation, quote-unquote. Why? Because at one point she fled with the kids to England. At another point, and the other reason he was convinced of this was that the kid hated his father, who was abusive, who was, you know, to the mom, pretty violent, to the kids, minor stuff like, you know, grabbing them by the ear, slapping them around, and very verbally abusive, you know, very hate-filled towards the mother. And the kids were bonded to the mother and did not, you know, were the older kid was old enough to really take an attitude and dislike his father for it. And because his kid hated his father, and the mom talked about abuse and took the kids to England, she was a shameless alienator. So that, to me, is kind of a paradigm of what goes wrong when alienation label is slapped on a case with a history of violence. And what ended up happening, purely as a result of that label, she lost custody entirely because the court adopted it. The court basically minimized even the two findings of abuse that the court had found and treated the rest of it as completely false, which made no sense. Given that he found that there
well,
was
how
some.
How severe was the abuse? What was the finding on the abuse?
Well, that's the thing. The abuse, the court treated it as very minor because what the guy admitted was, you know, a little bit of grabbing, a little bit of pushing, that kind of thing. I don't remember the exact specifics. It wasn't like he used weapons on her. But part of the problem I think that courts have is that they think that if the violence isn't seriously injurious, it's not a severe concern. And the fact is that if you're living with someone and they're willing to be violent with you, it's pretty terrifying. and it is also a signal of a lot of other kinds of danger emotionally for the kids. So,
well, and I think
it wasn't
too,
major
I mean,
violence,
talked
but
about
it was
this.
A history.
I mean, I'm a board member
violence.
On the Weitzman Center in Chicago, and Susan Weitzman
right.
wrote the book Not to People Like Us, which is about upscale, which I hate that word, but upscale emotional and physical abuse. It doesn't always have to be physical. It can
right.
be emotional abuse, like it was
right.
in my case, where you're called names,
yep.
you're put down to your children, and it's over
yep.
and over and over. So
yep.
so I think
so that's a lot
you know,
of what it was here, but with some physical. But, you know, fairly minor in the big picture, but enough physical to say the man's a danger. And when I finish the story, you'll know more. So I think that's a very good point, that in the middle and upper class, you often see kind of less extreme violence, but plenty of abusiveness, and there's danger attached to it. Some of those cases are the cases where kids wind up getting killed. They never were extremely violent in the past, but after the separation, after the family court refuses to restrict their access to the kids, they take the kids and kill them because their agenda is to destroy the mother. And there was a case like that in Maryland where he said to her, I'm going to kill everybody. No, he said, I'll kill the kids and leave you alive. That would be the best way to hurt you. And that's what he did, because the family court refused to believe her and let him have the kids. He drowned them
okay,
in the
bathtub. Okay, but let's not make the mistake, the three of us, of merging the two things together. They don't really belong together. Not really.
Right. Right. So that was my example of how they get merged wrongfully, like one is used to negate the other. And so because I see that, my agenda is to kind of separate them out and get courts to say, look, if there's abuse, we're not going to go into the alienation thing, because that's really just used as a way to deny and minimize the abuse. If it's the abuser calling her an alienator because she alleges abuse, because she flees abuse, because the kids hate him for the abuse, that's not alienation. We're not going to go there. It's abuse.
All right, let's talk about how this really would work. How it would really work is, let's say it's the man, okay? The man hits the woman. It's abuse, okay? At the same time, you're saying it's not possible that the woman, as a result of being hit or not as a result of being hit, enters into a course of conduct to destroy the children's relationship with their father. You see, that's not okay, no matter what he did.
It's not, but here's the thing.
And the nuance
is what do the children know
on their own?
Which is more okay, though.
Let me just finish the sentence. The nuance really being, what do the children know on their own? Perhaps they come to disliking the father on their own. That's always the question. How do they get to that
right.
place?
But
you can have a guy who's done wrong by his wife and also, believe it or not, can parent,
yeah.
but to destroy the relationship
yeah.
with the kid is abuse then to
right.
the children.
That would be true if that were happening. But what's really happening is abused women and children who were reacting to the abuse are being accused of alienation, and the abuse is being minimized and denied. See, if you were willing to say to me, I recognize that hitting your wife means you're dangerous, and I'm not hearing that yet. I'm hearing you minimized by calling it hitting. And in fact, a course of conduct of abusiveness is more than just a little hitting.
No,
it's
I said
dangerous,
hitting
and it
because
has,
I wanted to, you to understand
yeah.
I wasn't talking about emotional or threatening.
Okay.
I mean hands-on
okay.
stuff.
But I think hitting, you know, we've all hit somebody at some point in our young lives, so it doesn't sound that bad. But domestic
violence. No, it sounds terrible.
I mean
hitting.
Me,
I mean the bad kind.
I mean,
it's all bad.
What we know in the field is that if you hit your wife, you're a danger to your kids. So first of all, right off, you're a danger emotionally and physically to your kids. There's a six-time higher rate of sexual abuse of kids by men who hit their wives. Okay? The risk of kids are way, way up if you hit your wife. That's the first thing. The second thing is there's no data to show that women who are battered are alienating their kids any more than any other woman. Now, it's possible that lots of women are doing it, some are battered, some aren't. But it's not what we see. What we see is women who are trying to protect themselves and their kids being accused of alienation. And if you accept that that's going on, and it's going on too much, and I can, you know, there are thousands. I mean, we are daily with these calls and emails every week. I can't tell you how widespread and how severe, and the horror stories are off the chart. I mean, these kids wound up.
Are you on
a
speakerphone?
So,
I can't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's a cell phone.
Yeah, that's better.
Okay, I just moved it
a
little
bit.
I'm sorry. So
yeah,
I'm saying there's thousands. This problem that I'm describing of the way the courts are getting it wrong is so extreme that's my point, that both the cases are extreme and the numbers are off the charts. And given that, my position is this, not that it's impossible for a woman to alienate kids, Not that it's impossible for a batterer to be good to his kids, but that the risk is so high that we're going to turn battering into, we're going to turn accusations of battering against the victim and call her an alienator and reward the batterer that way. The risk is so high that we need to prioritize not doing that and assessing abuse first and cleaning out the case. So if it's not about abuse, fine, we can talk about alienation. But if it's not only about abuse, let me add one thing. There are a lot of kids who are alienated from their dads because their dads behave badly. It may not be abuse. Their dads may have had nothing to do with them, and then they get divorced and they start fighting for custody.
Another,
and the kids don't want to do
thing.
Half and half.
Right. That's another.
Right? There are a thousand reasons why dads who are not necessarily abusive may have alienated kids, and it's not the mother's fault. And the problem with the alienation theory is that it's being used against the parent that the kid likes. By definition, usually mothers in my experience, I don't see courts punishing fathers for alienation. I hardly ever, even when they should. But maybe you're doing that, and that seems important to me. But there's so many reasons why kids get alienated from their father, and alienation really is a gendered theory because it's been used against women. It was designed to be used against women alleging abuse, and that's how it's being used primarily, at least in what I see and hear about. And so the problem with the theory, even when we're not even talking about abuse, is that it's giving these men a free pass. They can be lousy fathers. Their kids can be pissed off at them for any number of reasons, and the moms get blamed and the dad gets more custody. And the courts aren't really looking at
like
why the kids may not like their dad.
It's not like that. As a matter of fact, and I can only speak for my county in Chicago, but I can tell you that when somebody comes to court alleging alienation, they have to jump through rings of fire to get the court's attention. As a matter of fact, it's kind of the opposite, that a lot of the time the people who may be alienators are able to destroy the relationship by the time the case gets to a hearing so that the judge can pull the facts apart and decide what's really going on. So my experience on
the alienation
is the
opposite. So what are the hoops
that
they have to jump through? What are the hoops? I have never heard of any hoops for alienation.
Well, it's kind of what you just said. You've got to be able to show that the children haven't reached their own conclusion and felt distanced and not wanting to be with the targeted parent. You have to show that the other parent, the alienating parent, went into a course of conduct that actually affirmatively showed that he or she did something. What they did, said, canceled visitation, lying the parent.
Is there a legal requirement?
We don't have alienation on the books, but we do have on the books that the parent who gets custody, right, but the parent who gets custody has to, one of the factors is who fosters the relationship with the other parent better.
Right, but
so
when you
when
say
I
they
say
have to jump through hoops, what you're saying is some judges are requiring that?
Yeah, alienation is not so well liked around here.
Good.
And therefore, the parent who may really be getting alienated really has to try and document and keep going to court and spending a lot of money to keep it in front of the judge's attention that this is actually happening.
Michelle, you are so cavalierly talking about this. It's making me almost sick to my stomach because you know as well as I do that jumping through hoops is the most remedial description of what I had to do, of what alienated parents have to do. You have to jump through hoops. You have to spend $1 million. You have to be drugged through character assassination. And I'm talking as a woman.
That's what better women have to do.
But absolutely.
Exactly,
absolutely. But I could line up for you, Joan, in Illinois. I could line men up from Cairo, Illinois, all the way to Rockford that have had to jump through hoops and beyond to try just to see their children. And it is ridiculous. The system that exists
no
in Illinois and all across this country.
There was no abuse in these cases? There was no abuse at issue in these cases?
Well, certainly there were abuse issues, false allegations of sexual abuse and
right.
domestic violence issues.
See, that's
that
the problem,
came up. And
Bill.
I know, but Joan, I know these men, and I know, I mean, I can cite to you one guy in Chicago, Illinois, that is a lawyer who has desperately been trying to just see his daughter, and all, and I know this man. I mean, I can vouch for him. I know him. And he has been accused of everything in the book. And it is ridiculous what goes on, and it is just churned by lawyers and court appointed advocates and GALs in Illinois. And I tell you, being on the Illinois Family Law Study Committee, I feel like I've done my job in trying to put parental alienation issues in the new divorce law that's going to be produced.
Let me ask you something, though. I mean, what you're saying is horrific, and what it may suggest, you know, if it's true, and I tend to think that all these claims of false abuse allegations are overstated, and a lot of those are probably true, but even if you're right that they're all false, all the ones you believe and trust are false, what we're talking about then is a system that's getting it wrong in both directions, right? It's sending kids
Absolutely.
To terrible abusers
Absolutely.
And cutting them off from protective mothers, and it's removing kids from perfectly decent fathers and mothers and giving them to, you know, poisonous, emotionally poisonous parents. And so the cure, I don't know, but let me ask you this. If it's true, even if this is true in both directions, it's horrible, which is worse for kids? To be sent to a father who's going to sexually abuse you for the rest of your life until you can get out of the house?
Why is that a criteria, though?
Let me finish. If that's the trade-off, if the court has to figure out which evil is lesser, one lesser than another?
I don't know. I mean, is that arsenic or strychnine is worse of a poison?
Yeah,
I'm not
right.
even
well,
understanding
I don't know. If I'm
question.
A kid, I'll tell you what I choose. I choose not to be with the abusive parent. I choose to be with the parent who poisons my mind. I would take that
Yeah, but that kind of thinking doesn't get us into problem solving. That doesn't.
But
that
I think
not
it does,
help us
because,
figure out the problem. Is to
well,
say, would you
problem,
rather be with somebody who's a hatchet murderer or somebody
but,
who's
going
to strangle
is,
you
But the problem is,
Michelle,
forward. Is that courts are getting it wrong so much. And my position is that courts can't get it right most of the time, and so they need to be humble about what they can ascertain. And when they're not sure, they should err on the side of not sending kids to abusive parents. That's my
Well,
view.
I'm absolutely with you on that. Courts are getting it wrong because there's not enough people like Michelle. That's absolutely right.
Well, the only thing, what it really takes is a really in-depth look at the evidence. Not
yeah.
snapping to anybody's prejudicial
yeah.
conclusions.
Yeah.
Not
yep.
any prejudices yep. that the three of us have. Not
right.
ever. Because to talk in an inflammatory way allows
right.
judges to make snap conclusions. We can't be the person we don't want judges to be.
I agree with that, Michelle, and I appreciate that comment. And here's the thing. These evaluators who come in and slap an alienation label on people who are trying to protect kids are simply doing that. They're inflaming and they're telling judges to ignore the evidence. And what the judges
Joan,
then do is they ignore the facts. They go with the label.
Joan,
well,
would it be better
the most,
for you?
The single
well,
most
Hang on, Michelle. Would it be better for you, Joan, if you saw people going into court and not using that label, just simply describing
yep.
behaviors? What
yep.
is that
Much
a red
better.
Flag?
And you know
okay.
why it would be better, Jill? Because you wouldn't have
what?
The imprimatur of an expert opinion. You would have facts. And the court sits there and wades through the facts, and that's their job, and I'm all for that.
But don't you need
okay,
an expert?
I want to take
really
a call.
Diverting
I want to take a
facts.
Call. We've got a call from the 863 area code. I think this is Eric Rommerhaus from Florida. Eric, are you on?
Yeah, Jill, I'm on.
Do you have a question
How are you
for Joan? I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I do. I do. First off, if I can make a quick comment, I mean, this whole topic has been about you know, men as the stereotypical abuser. I do want to set the record straight, and I'm hoping you just use this, and I'm sure you guys are just using a hypothetical example that from the statistics that I've seen, and I'd be curious to see input from you from all of you as far as the you know, typically men that are abused do not report it. It's embarrassing. They're ashamed. There's, you know, from my understanding, based on the VAWA standard, which gets $1 billion of funding, a lot of these shelters will not even let men victims in to their shelter. So I just want to you know, set the record straight from the statistics that I've been hearing, that the abuse, the domestic violence is actually 50-50. There's 50% women perpetrators and 50% men. And
what
from the other statistics I've seen.
Where does that come from? Eric, let us know, because I got to
figure it out. It's an organization called Save for Falsely Accused. There's a PhD that did studies
There's tons of literature that says that. Should I jump in here, Jill?
Yeah.
Or
absolutely.
Eric?
Okay, go ahead, Jill.
Yeah, there's a lot of literature. Is it Eric? Did I get that right?
Yeah, Eric, yes.
Okay, yeah, thanks for your call. There is a lot of literature that women are violent, too, and here's where I want to get a little more nuanced, because what we're finding is that a lot of kind of anti-VAWA and anti-DV intervention activists are touting that as reason to back off on protective orders and so forth. It's not clear to me that a lot of men who need protection aren't asking for it. And what I know about the shelters, and there have been a series of lawsuits against DV programs around the country, and so I've learned some of the arguments on both sides. But the shelters, generally what they do and what they're required to do if it comes up, is they give a voucher to a man. You can't put a man in a women's shelter, particularly a shelter of women who are being abused by men, because that would open the door to potential abusers tracking their victims. So what you do if you have a women's shelter and a man needs protection, you give them a voucher to go somewhere safe. And the services are typically available in terms of counseling and legal help. So it's not true. I think it's a myth. It's not to say that it's never happened, that a man's been turned away and given no help. But typically, that's what shelters do. And, of course, statistically, they get very, very, very few of those requests for help. And many of them are men who are trying to set up litigation, who are trying to get a turn away so they can file suit.
But in terms of what really
matters about your question, can I just address the issue of dangerousness?
Sure.
It may be that men and women are, when you look at hitting or touching or, you know, pushing and shoving or slapping, that kind of stuff, I don't know for sure the exact statistics, but it is certainly true. There's a lot of research that suggests that women do that kind of minor physical stuff as much as men or close. What is not true, however, is that the dangerous, controlling type of abusive conduct is committed by women equally. And what everyone agrees who's looking at these data is that the power and control dynamic, which is the dynamic that signals real dangerousness, tends to be a male one used against women or male partners. You know, in same-sex partnerships, it happens too.
And I would add to that, I can't talk about men being embarrassed, but men do come to court. And
yeah.
They do come to court, and they say, here's my scratch. Here's the bump on my head. Here's the bruise. Easily. And they may have.
Yeah,
and there may be people who are not coming, Eric. I'm not saying that's not true.
We also see.
The statistics are still more heavily dominated to men. And we didn't mean to offend you in any way by using that as the example. But,
no, I happen to be a falsely accused father myself, and I've turned my effort into advocacy to help others, and
Eric,
story about three falsely accused fathers in Florida, and how typically men are stereotypically getting the bad rap.
Eric, don't you think though? In Florida, it's almost like it's pandemic. When it happens, then someone sees it, and it happens again and again and again. And I think Florida is a hotbed of that. Don't you?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I talk to men all the time. We run a support group down here, and I talk to men all the time that, you know, that if there was violence, and a lot of it, from what I'm ascertaining, is one-sided, and the statistics from that Save for the Falsely Accused organization by that PhD actually states that when it's one-sided partner aggression or partner abuse, 70% of the perpetrators are women. In other words, the woman would hit the man, and the man, you know, if there's some jerks out there that will, you know, obviously do the wrong thing, but a lot of men don't hit back, and it's
right. And the question is whether that kind of thing, if that's a slap or a shove, and I will cop to occasionally, you know, kind of an anger, kind of in jokingness, giving a little punch to my husband. I mean, that kind of stuff. If that's what we're counting, then it's probably, you know, more like 80 or 90% of people do that, and women do it because they know they're not going to hurt him, and they're not going to scare him, and he's not scared. It's, you know, a little bit of annoyance.
The problem
so it depends on what they're counting. Are they counting the kind of violence
that
scares someone? That's the question.
right, that, well, from the men that I speak with, this is from the opposite perspective, and I don't think domestic violence is really a gender-based issue. I think it happens both to men and women. We see it all the time in the news. It happens to both, you know, both sexes. But from the men that I'm speaking with, you know, a lot of it is one-sided, and in fact, you know, you've
got... Are they scared by what the woman does to them? If
oh,
the woman's
well,
violent,
yeah,
they
absolutely.
Don't know.
They're
oh,
frightened.
Yeah.
They're
I'm going to say,
and
the men in my courtroom
depends.
Are plenty scared.
yeah,
yeah,
well,
yeah, I mean,
they are.
But
they're
not scared.
And they're ashamed.
No, if they're coming, if they're getting protection and they need protection, then that they're doing the right thing. But I don't know if these data are capturing cases of violence that's scary violence or cases of she slapped him, which I don't think should be counted in this conversation.
But I can tell you plenty of men that
I've
spoken to have bruises, and it's never reported. The men will not report it because they're humiliated. It's not things that men do. They don't go in and report the shell. I mean, they've grown up in a society where they're grown up in a society where it's biased against men. It's very biased against, to be a man in our society and to be hit by a woman is – you're an outcast. I mean, you can't go talk to people about stuff like that.
You know,
I mean,
I hear men say that, but I don't see that in the courts. I see the courts welcoming men's claims. I see the courts being much more misogynist than anything else, particularly in the custody setting. I do think in the protection order setting, there's probably a leaning towards women, although in my court in D.C., we've seen enormous leaning over towards men because they're afraid of being gender biased. So they're awarding protection orders to a lot of abusers who jump to court before the woman gets there and they get their protection order. It's a preemptive strike, we call it, and it happens all the time. But so I don't see men being afraid to go to court, afraid to allege to be a victim at all. And I see men, the courts being very responsive to that.
Make sure that we know that it's important that Eric is really giving the male perspective, which we need to hear, which is that men really are embarrassed by it. It doesn't matter what I see. I need to know the male psyche, because if you're telling me that in this day and age,
well, Eric, 2010, are you saying that you know that, or are you saying that you hear that? Because I'd like to
know
firsthand. I'd like to hear from a man.
And I hear it all the time. Firsthand.
It's been your experience as well? Yeah, okay.
Yes, it's been my experience as well, yes.
Okay, all right, that's important to me.
Eric,
because
thank
I do
you.
Hear
thank
a lot
you.
Of activists making claims that I think are simply not true, and society and court swayed by them, and they're simply not accurate. But if it's true for you, that I take seriously.
Right, well, in my instance, I not only was a victim, but then my ex had used false allegations to go to court, and I'm not here to preach my case. That's not what it's about. I mean, I'm about the... you know, getting done what's right and helping the true victims of domestic violence, because a lot of services and funds are being diverted to fund false allegations when, you know, you have a vindictive spouse, whether male or female, to go into family court to try to use it to gain custody, the windfall in the finances, support in the primary residence.
That's where I take issue with you, Eric, because what I see is the opposite. And I will say, just to lend what little credibility it might lend to my position, my organization, which obviously represents mostly women, took a case of a man who said exactly that. He said his wife had fabricated, and a domestic violence organization represented him, and there were reasons that we all believed that it was fabricated. Another domestic violence organization represented her, and they were enraged at us, and I took the appeal on his behalf. So it's not that I think it can never happen, but that's one case in 20 years where I had reason to believe it was the case that she falsely went to court and succeeded in deluding a judge to give her an order that was wrong. And there the court didn't do the thorough look that I think the court should have done, and that's what we argued on appeal. So it's not that it never happens, but my concern is that activists, men's rights activists, have been touting the idea that it's rampant, and it's really fueled courts' resistance to hearing from women in custody. And there's this notion that when women alleged abuse in custody, they're doing it falsely to win. And I don't see that. I'm not saying it can't happen, but I can tell you thousands of horror stories where the abuse is true and the kids are being sent to abusers over and over. And many of them, we've documented 75 cases of homicide of children by fathers after women went to court and begged the court not to give him access. The court said, no, you're a vengeful ex-wife. I'm giving him his visitation. And then he murdered the kids. And so the problem is real, of courts not believing true allegations. I don't know how real the other one is. I know that it's touted all the time.
When you talk about the murdered kids cases, though, you're talking about such severe pathology.
Yeah,
that's
but not
really
serious history of violence. But not really pathology. These are men who are so vengeful to their exes that they are going to murder the kids to hurt the exes. And that's what they
so
do.
So for so many years, Joan, every domestic violence order was being entered. Every protective order for the children, don't let the parent see the child if there was any allegation.
No,
of
I'm not
any
saying
abuse.
That.
But this
I'm
is
not
what
saying
happened.
That, though.
Let me just tell you what happened, though. What happened
that's
was
not what we're
error
asking
in
for.
Favor of the children. Error in favor of the children. No matter
but they
what
never cut
the
off
story was.
Did they, Michelle? I've
all
never seen
time.
A court cut off
all
education.
The time.
Not in
well,
my
let's
court.
Look into this. Let's look into this. And probably this was
never.
Right. What I'm
never.
Saying is
unheard of. They don't
well, let
cut
me,
it off.
Hold on. What I'm saying is one killing of children, one horrendous act like that, and you saw the court's ripple effect into
yeah.
always bending, that's what I'm saying, always
okay.
bending over backwards without, you know, and really needing to find out what was going on there.
You know,
that's
I think we need some real empirical data because we're both talking about what always happens, and it's the exact opposite
well,
of
I wouldn't
each other.
Use the word always.
And I just find it so
vocabulary.
Hard to believe because I never, I mean, even back when things were not as severe and the courts were less, I don't know, their alienation hadn't cropped up yet, so they were just more looking at the facts and stuff. They still never cut off visitation, even then.
Well, John,
my point
John,
is only
listen,
this.
There,
this is my point. My point is
all
only.
What's your
when,
point?
When you talk about children being murdered, you miss the whole issue. That's my point.
No. The issue I'm trying to make is that these are cases where the mothers were sincere and were correct, and they were saying to the court not, oh, he's an abuser, don't let him have my kids. They were saying, he's going to murder my kids. Here's how I know it. He said this. He did that. He's going to kill them. And the courts did not believe the women because they believed what Eric is saying, that so many women come to court and lie vengefully to withhold the kids from their from their ex. They believe what Eric says. They don't believe the truth. And what happens is kids die and get abused as a result. That's what I see. And we're documenting these 75 around the country just in the last year of the murders. But I see thousands where it's just merely abuse. Or even if it's not even severe abuse, they're losing their mother. They're being cut off from their mother who raised them, which is bad enough. And it's because courts believe what Eric is saying. That in my experience,
but
they believe
can
that
I make a quick comment?
Ex-wives.
Yes,
can
Eric,
I make
go
a quick
ahead.
Comment?
Yes.
I was going to say that, I mean, based on that premise that all men are abusers and all men are
I'm not saying that.
Violent.
Nobody's
well,
saying that.
I don't think
but
she's saying that, Eric.
Well, that's
the
you
problem
know, there,
with
there
this
is
kind of rhetoric, Eric. I'm not saying all men. I have a lovely husband, and I know lots of great men. And you sound like a lovely man. I'm not saying all men are anything. I'm saying when
okay.
a woman comes to court and says, he's going to kill the kids, and here's how I know it and why I'm so afraid, they should be taken seriously and not written off as a vengeful ex-wife
but,
by definition.
Herein lies
oh,
the problem.
Oh, my goodness, I don't think they are. Oh, my what? Goodness. If somebody brings in any evidence where the children might be injured, I can't imagine a judge is going to
Michelle,
say, you're a vengeful
we're documenting
ex-wife.
Michelle, come on.
The cases are in the yeah. media. I can send you all the cases. It is absolutely
yeah, but
true.
But what I'm saying is, I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I'm not saying that I don't even know judges who have made the wrong decision. I'm just not sure I understand that it really speaks to the issue that we're trying to speak to.
Why
because
it's
an extreme example when you have somebody talking about
no,
killing the kids.
The outcome is extreme, but it speaks to the issue, even if he didn't kill the kids. What it speaks to is judges believing what Eric is saying and not believing women. That's the problem in the courts. Women are being disbelieved when they are telling the truth about dangers. That's what's going on.
Here's
there are a lot
problem.
Of activists who are out there arguing that the opposite is going on, and courts are listening to them, and that is fueling the disbelief of women. That's
okay.
my view of what's
okay,
going
stop.
On.
I want everybody to stop, and what I want to say is this, and Eric, thank you for your call, and I'm just going to cut you off here, and we're going to talk, but what obviously – what you're saying, Joan, happens. There are men who abuse women, and these women go into court and they lose their children. But there are also women and men who go into court and lose their children due to parental alienation syndrome because the correct decisions aren't made by a judge. They're not acting swiftly. Time is the friend of parental alienation and parental alienation syndrome. What is the solution, Joan?
Yeah.
What do you propose
that we do to change? I told you what my solution is. I really think we have to triage out real abuse cases and not be mixing those up with alienation claims. That's the first step. When there's independent alienation, and when I say triage them out, Michelle, just to do justice to what you raised before, if it's minor abuse and the adjudication or the expert assessment, and the expert assessment has to be a true abuse expert and not these fake custody experts, but a real abuse expert or a judge doing fact-finding concludes, on a founded basis that there's no danger to these kids, that's one thing, and then you go from there. I'm not saying that when you triage out abuse that none of those fathers get visits. Not at all. I'm just saying when you find abuse, you then assess risk to the kids, and you assign custody and visitation accordingly. Then, in all the rest of the cases where there's alienation, go to it and try to parse what's going on. But if it's abuse, deal with that first. Triage it and assess what should flow from those findings before you start leaping to the alienation conclusion and using alienation theory as a way to sort of negate an abuse claim, because that's how it's used. In my experience, and Michelle, I'm sure you're doing it differently and better because it sounds like you're doing it very thoughtfully, but what we see a lot is the minute an alienation is raised, the abuse becomes false in the judge's mind. That's the end of it. And it doesn't matter what the facts are because those facts are just turned into an alienation theory. That's the problem with mixing them up in the same case. That's why I say take the abuse cases out, assess the abuse, and assess the implications. Does it mean that he's perfectly safe? Does it mean that he should have limited visitation? Does it mean it needs to be supervised? What does it mean? But assess it in the context of your findings of abuse. And if you find no abuse, send it back into the regular pipeline and assess the alienation. Then I say, when you're looking at alienation, it should be real alienation in the sense twofold. One is there should be actual conduct by the so-called alienator. You can't just say the kid doesn't like me, therefore it's her fault. And the other one is the kid has to be actively, resistant to that parent. It's not just, like I've had too many cases where the kid didn't want joint custody. She didn't want to split her time. And they call that alienation, and that's nonsense. Who wants to split their time between two houses? That's not alienation. That's perfectly normal. And so that was used against the mother. So I'm saying let's be real about when it's truly alienation and when it's an array of other possible reasons why a kid may not want what the dad wants or what the alienated parent wants in terms of access. Let me just say one last thing, because I know there are a lot of women who are so fervent, like you, Jill, and Michelle, about alienation being, what destroyed your life or people you know. And I suspect that in many of those cases, and it sounds like somewhat maybe in yours, Jill, there's an abuse dynamic there, and the alienation is
absolutely
part of an abuse picture. And that's why I say, I'm not saying there's no such thing, but when it's part of an abusive pattern, call it abuse. Call it what it is and assess it. And assess its implications for the kids. One of those implications is destroying the kid's relationship with the abused parent. That was you in this case. Mm-hmm. And that should be part of the abuse assessment. But don't do it the way it's being done now to say, oh, the abuse is false because it's just alienation.
I guess the way I'm hearing it is, to me, it's axiomatic that the first thing you do is you've got to lay everything out in highways of thought. And one of the first highways of thought is the assessment as to whether or not there's abuse. The
mm-hmm.
other part, and the concomitant part, is there alienation? The idea that abuse is used, it is neutralized by a claim of alienation is really such an overgeneralization to me. And because I'm against overgeneralizations, because I think they only trigger emotional responses, they trigger judgmental responses and inflammatory reactions. The judges have to step up to the plate. everybody has to know that there is abuse on both sides, that sometimes alienators are abusive, but that's not the point. We got to focus on what are we doing here for the children. When we're labeling and branding and always and nevering, we can't get anywhere. This is highly complex. And,
that's exactly the point, Michelle. You can't get anywhere when you're doing all this. By the time you guys get your assessments done and by the time you decide what's going on and if this is this and if that is that, time is the friend of the alienator. And now you may not have had any domestic violence issues. But if you refer back to the Campion case, Elaine Campion in Canada, she drowned her two children because she didn't want her husband to have them. She had engaged in a vigorous campaign of parental alienation, and the ultimate form of domestic violence was she drowned her two girls and put them in bed and put pajamas on them and handed them a rosary and had them hold hands and then took a video and yelled at the ex-husband that he was never going to be able to see his kids again. You can see them in the casket. So by the time everybody's made the assessments and done all they need to do, it's too late.
Was there any sign that she was physically dangerous to anybody prior to that?
Well,
because that's what should have been paid attention to.
Absolutely should have. But when lawyers are spinning it and court-appointed advocates are involved that are making money off this system, I mean, I believe that's one of the real problems.
What do you see as a solution? What do you see? Because if if time is the problem, then... And I'm wary of assessments because I see so many bad ones, and they are kind of very incredibly expensive too. But what's the solution in your view?
I guess the solution, and really in the cases that you see when there is horrible domestic violence involved, I think that's a totally separate issue than this one.
Jill, I think it's easy to write mine off because some of them ended up horrible. But a lot of them look minor, like this Arkansas one. A lot of hitting, pushing, kicking, shoving, cornering. It didn't look like horrible domestic violence, but the ultimate outcome for the kids was horrible because the domestic violence was minimized because she was labeled an alienator. And there's the problem, Michelle, I have with assessing both at once is that alienation, if it's based on her claims of abuse, what you're doing is you're saying I'm going to assess abuse while I'm assessing the plausible likelihood that the abuse is false. You can't do them both at once without negating the abuse. You got to start one place or the other. And what ends up happening is that the implications of abuse, like kids getting pissed off at you or scared of you and not wanting to be in your custody, get overshadowed by the idea that means he's alienated rather than he's actually reacting to the abuse. And I see cases after cases where the abuse was pretty minor, and the kids have all kinds of resistance to the father for one reason or another. And the dad gets rewarded for that resistance because it's called alienation.
You don't do it at the same time. You're really not protecting the child at all. It's our job to do it at the same time. If I have a situation where somebody is hitting a parent and the parent that's being hit is doing a campaign against the hitter to the children, I got to stop that, don't I? And stop the hitting. Don't I have to protect the children at the same time?
But what is the campaign?
Time?
So let me make it harder for you, Michelle, because this is a real case. I don't know what the mom said. She's always denied saying anything negative, but I'm prepared to believe it's possible. Here's a story. Minor violence, I'll give you an example. He would shake her and throw her down on the bed. He had rage attacks. He would do reckless driving, double the speed in a matter of seconds to show her what it feels like not to be in control, quote unquote, that kind of stuff. At one point, he slammed a knife into a cutting board so hard that the tip broke off, and he said he wished that was her. The court found that the knife was true, but he didn't say whether he found the threat was true. That kind of stuff, okay?
Wait, what did the court say? What did the court say? I missed that.
The court said it found that the knife incident was true. It found that one of the reckless driving incidents... Actually, the court ignored some of these admissions. He admitted one of the reckless driving incidents. The knife was documented by photograph, and he admitted it, but he didn't admit the threat. The court found that he pulled a dish towel around her neck when they were in an argument and pulled her toward him, but the court did not find that he crossed it in front of her neck as though to choke her, which is what she testified. So that's the kind of history, and it spans over like 6 to 8 years before the final divorce. after the divorce, and the kids had the older kid had a decent relationship with the dad to all observers. Okay, nonetheless, the kid was exposed to all kinds of screaming and scary and somewhat physical, in the sense I've described, horrible altercations where the father was being physical and scary and intimidating and rageful. Okay, so she's exposed to that. But while they're living together, no, she's not alienated from him while they're living together. Now, after they separate, all of a sudden she's horribly
alienated
from him.
She's not alienated from who living together? What was that?
The dad, the perpetrator of this somewhat minor
was
violence.
Not alienated from the child.
He was not while they're together. Now,
okay.
They separate, okay? And after the separation, she does not want to keep seeing him. She does not want to have overnights with him. That becomes called alienation. What does she say about why she didn't want to see him anymore? She says that when she had her first overnight with him, with the little sister as well, he shook her, and she was sobbing and called her mother and said, and her mother said, how's it going? And she said, not well. He's shaking me, Mama. And her mama called Child Protection. Child Protection's reaction was to believe the dad and to say it was nothing, that it had been coached, even though there was no way it could have been coached because the kid was with her dad at the time. And all of that is used against Mama as more evidence of alienation. Now, the kid tells the evaluator that she wanted to see her dad until that visit. And after that visit, she was so angry at him, not only for shaking her, but for lying about what he had done, which of course he did, and lying about what he had done to her mother, which of course he did, that she was furious at him. This kid is a very righteous, you know, very smart, very righteous girl, and he really betrayed her emotionally in that way by being what he is, which is a jerk who can't keep his temper and gets physical sometimes, and he does it with her too, okay? You know, he's not going to kill anyone, I don't think. He's not that kind of guy. But he's rageful, and that's having a consequence now. But what everyone decided was that was alienation by the mother, who would have nothing to do with
it
anymore.
Oh, I'm sure there's more testimony than what – I'm sure there's more facts.
No, the testimony – well, there's a lot more detail. But in terms of evidence of alienation, there wasn't. I mean, here's what it was, and here's what everyone agreed it was. The mother's fear of him is rubbing off on the children, and that's alienation. And we know you don't mean it, but – it's having a negative effect on your kids. And therefore,
I don't think
he gets
that constitutes
custody.
Alienation myself.
Well, that's what the evaluator said.
Because a child,
that alienation
a mother's fear rubbing off on a child
is alienating
is
her from her father.
Generationally, all of our fears rub off on our children.
Right. That's right.
That's the burdens, especially in divorce, that we transfer to our kids because we don't
right.
know how to not transfer it. So this
well,
is
I hate
exactly
to break
the
up
but
this.
But you see, they're calling it alienation because it's the mother's feelings affecting the child, and they called it enmeshment, which is the child identifying with the mother and being afraid he was going to kill everybody, afraid he would kill her or kill all of them. And they called that enmeshment, and they basically said, even though you don't mean to, you're alienating your children. And they gave him joint custody because the child was alienated. Now, why was she really alienated? Maybe the mother's stuff is rubbing off on her. That's perfectly plausible. But why? Because he was abusive. He caused fear in the family. His behavior, his very bad, rageful, and abusive behavior created ripple effects of fear in the family. And it came to a head after the separation because she went through it directly herself when he shook her for the first time alone with him, having him direct his rage at her. So they're calling that alienation. I call that abuse. And that's the problem with assessing them both at once.
I understand.
Well, John and Michelle, we gotta wrap this up. And because I wanna have you come back, John, because I think this has been an outstanding show and clearly we're working towards the same end goal to fix this screwed up system.
I think we are.
I do think we are.
And I really appreciate what both of you have said.
And I absolutely am just so pleased that you took time tonight to come on with us.
I thought Eric was a good kind of voice
to our debate. So please come back again, and this show will be online for people to listen to and weigh in on, and we hope that we can have you again, and let's work all of us towards trying to make the system better for children, our most precious commodity. Thank you, Joan. Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you very much, everybody. Pleasure
thank
to
you both.
Spend this hour with you.
I really appreciate the
take
conversation.
Take care now. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
The look of love is in your eyes.
Thank you.